Okay, tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about power and authorities in American families and look at some of the major sociological changes and factors that have contributed to a shifting in the power balance, if you want to call it that, or in the authority system of the American family. And basically this argument will be based on the notion that American families, at least for the past several hundred years, have been characterized by what we would call a patriarchal form of authority, and that recent changes in people's behavior and attitudes has started to undermine two of the important foundations on which patriarchy rests, male gender and older age. And I will refer mostly to authority, okay? Power, as a lot of sociologists define it anyhow, is usually thought of as the ability to get one's own way even in the face of opposition, okay? And stark power or bare power usually takes the form, when you get right down to it, of physical ability to realize one's own wishes, to get one's way in the face of opposition. I briefly want to say that that underlying a lot of the authority in the family, there is power, okay? And one of the ways that we've begun to realize that is through the study of domestic abuse, okay? What we find is that these are families in which the authority system is stripped down, and we see the bare power that underlies the relationships between the people in the family, okay? And what we learn from that is that in our society, there are still many women who are in fear of physical assault, physical abuse, in fear of the greater physical power of the people with whom they live. Now, this does not always take the form of wife abuse, and this is why I'm referring to it as domestic abuse. Recently, for instance, we've become aware of older women who are living with their children who are abused. We're also aware that while male children under the age of 12 are more likely to be abused than their sisters, that from the age of 12 on, female children are more likely to be abused in the family situation. So we have a situation in America of a good deal of female abuse within what is supposed to be the most nurturing, the most protective, the most fulfilling of American institutions. And another fact that I want to point out with regard to this power is that it is something that has been ignored by our ideology. When we first got into the area of abuse, we found that there was a great deal of blaming the victim. She asked for it. She provoked it. Why does she stay in this situation? If he's so bad and she's so scared of him, why does she stay there? And the reasons that were given were usually deep psychological ones, such as the inherent masochism of female personality, or the desire of women to blend pleasure with pain in their psychic life, and this kind of nonsense, okay? What has shifted the balance of beliefs here is that as the society has provided alternative escape routes for people in these situations, we find that they take full advantage of them, okay? That in other words, if a shelter is available, which a woman knows her husband cannot find, she will go to it. If a law is passed that says he can't enter the property, she will go to that justice of the peace and get that kind of declaration from the judge. If therapy is available, she will go seek it out, okay? If the divorce laws of the state are fair and provide for her economically, she will seek a divorce, okay? So that what was often thought of as just female adherence to the family no matter what is now being shown to be simply their powerlessness formerly within these situations. That as long as you're going to starve if you send the breadwinner to jail, or as long as he's going to kill you if you run away and he can find you, or as long as there's no way to keep him off the property, women did not escape from these situations, and they appeared not to be trying to. But now we see that once options are available, women take advantage of them. We realize that this was a situation which was simply a stark situation of power versus powerlessness. Now, fortunately for most of us, most family structures do not operate in terms of power, okay? They operate in terms of authority, which is institutionalized power, power that people accept as part of their social situation, either because they believe in it or because they were raised to think it's correct, or because they see it as a functional part of society to do so. And authority is often thought of by sociologists as adhering in three possible locations, okay? One is the notion of traditional authority. This is the idea that a person obeys another person or lets that other person take control because it's always been that way, okay? Historically, probably the best example of this is the divine right of kings, okay? People did what kings said because they believed it had always been that way, because these people had an inherent right, and so on. And papal authority, which we saw a little bit of here in Philadelphia last fall, is also traditional. Whoever has held that role has commanded power and authority. Okay. The second idea is that of charismatic authority. That is, that there's some characteristic of the personality of an individual that just compels other people to follow them, okay? And Max Weber, who was the sociologist who thought up this scheme, was very, very parsimonious in who he felt had been charismatic, and limited his analysis to Moses, Jesus, and Mohammed, okay? Since then, the term has gotten more into the vernacular, and we hear about Kennedy charisma, and in fact, the Pope's charisma was spoken of a great deal while he was here. Finally, there is rational legal authority, which is where there are rules, regulations, customs that make people obey or follow. Now, in the family, you often find some kind of combination of these. All right. For instance, a lot of the ideology of patriarchy comes out of the idea that men have always ruled the family, that it's an inherent part of the human experience, and that therefore they have an inherent right to rule the family. Okay, and this is typical of Western culture and of many other cultures. Okay, but it's not characteristic of all cultures, as I will mention in a minute. In terms of charisma, on a very individual level, we all know that marriages are compromises, okay? Quite frequently, one person in a family situation is more in love or cares more than the other person. That other person kind of has them slaved by their charisma. But also, we find that the society imposes rational legal notions on the family, which are invisible, and we don't think about them very much. I don't know how many people in the room really could start telling me the premises of family law, okay? But I'm going to unmask some of those this evening, and we'll see how strongly that rational legal system has operated to, quote, keep women in their place within the family. Now, patriarchy is but one form of family system. Briefly, we can see that there are basically three kinds of authority systems that characterize families across the globe. Patriarchy, which is the rule of adult males, which is a Western characteristic. Democratic decision-making, which we find in many so-called primitive groups, such as the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, the Pygmies of the Congo, where decisions about what a family will do or what the children will do or how they will be raised are jointly arrived at by many members in the family, including perhaps part of the extended family, grandparents, aunts, uncles, the mother and father, and matriarchal systems, of which there is only one known historical example, which is the Iroquois Confederation, where women essentially controlled all the property in the society, held all the political power, ran the families, and in fact had total power within the family situation. Now, this society has tended to be in the power of Western Europeans who brought with them the custom of patriarchy. Many of the minority groups which find themselves in this society came from backgrounds where the democratic family process was more common. For instance, in West Africa, women have much more to say about their own destinies within the family, and they play a more active role in the decision-making process. The same could be said for Native American families as well. Asiatic families, on the other hand, also brought with them a highly patriarchal set of values and customs, which were transplanted into the New World. Now, what I'm arguing is that the 19th century American woman was very much at the mercy of a male-dominated patriarchal system, but that through the two mass movements of women, the suffragist movement and the women's liberation movement, plus many of the changes in their behavior that have nothing to do with ideology, such as their increased participation in the labor force, the decline in the birth rate, women and youth are challenging the right of men to rule the family, okay? And that this is taking place by attacks on both the sex issue and the age issue. Okay, now when we look at 19th century women, we find that the law had a great deal to say about power in the family and who had it. And what it said, to paraphrase Blackstone, was that upon marriage, the man and the woman become one, and that one is the husband. When a woman married, she stopped having a legal definition in the United States. She could not sue. She could not be sued because she didn't exist in civil court, okay? She couldn't vote. She could not own property. She could not manage property that had been left to her, nor could she dispose of it. For instance, if she wanted to sell something that had been left to her in a will, she could not do so unless her husband was willing to take that kind of action, all right? Now, one of the immediate things that was the product of the first women's movement was something called the Women's Property Acts. And these wiped out a lot of this kind of situation. For instance, the Property Acts made it possible for women to sue. It made it possible for them to own property, whether they were married or not. And it gave them management and control over their own property. And I think this is important because immediately we can see women getting more options within the family about what they want to do. And also we see them gaining some status under the law in the ability to take a legal action, which they previously could not do. Nonetheless, there is in our society a good deal of restriction still built into the way the law views a marriage, okay? The law has a tacit assumption about a promise, a contract that is made in marriage that dates back into medieval Europe, okay? And basically, the legal notion of what happens in a marriage is the following, that marriage is a contract, like other economic contracts, in which two people state and promise that they will make an exchange of goods and services, and that each party must adhere to this promise, okay? Now, what is the nature of that promise? What are the nature of the goods and services? The assumption the law makes still, I will argue, although it's changing gradually, is that a woman promises to give her services in exchange for a man's support, okay? That his obligations are to put a roof over her head, shelter, to provide her with food and clothing, and that she, on the other hand, has the following obligations. She must keep house, she must bear and raise children, and she must engage in sex when her husband wishes. Now, you can all immediately think, I'm sure, as I said that last thing, of a recent challenge to this notion, which is the question of whether a husband can rape a wife or not. Is that possible under the law? So far, the law has not chosen to take that issue on, which is a tacit affirmation, I would say, of the idea that women owe men to whom they are married their sexual services. The law has never yet admitted there was such a thing as rape within the marriage contract. Okay. Now, let me give you some examples of cases that have attempted to break through this rather rigid notion of what a woman is supposed to do in her marriage. And let me say before I talk about the cases that we have to remember these cases are happening in a society where there's not too much sense to this legal notion of what the contract is. The reason for that is that we can no longer make a clear distinction between the wife staying at home and providing these services and the husband going into what's referred to as the public domain and providing the money to support his wife. In fact, with 53% of our women in the labor force now, we have to say that both parties really are doing what used to be thought of as the male role, and that this brings on a demand for men to assume more of the tasks that used to be thought of as female roles, such as helping to care for the children, housekeeping, marketing, cooking, and the like. Okay, now the first case I want to talk about is Mrs. McGuire. And I'm using as a reference a book called Rights and Wrongs, which was put up by the Feminist Press and written by Carrie Nicholas and Alice Price, both of whom were involved in the Philadelphia Women's Law Project and who teach a course for us at Penn on women and the law. Mrs. McGuire's case is very interesting because it makes very clear just what the extent of the male obligation really is. Okay. Let me tell you a bit about Lydia McGuire. Lydia McGuire was the wife of a Nebraska farmer who complained to the state, and this is in 1953, that although she worked in the fields, cleaned, cooked, and washed throughout a 34-year marriage, her husband had never provided for her properly. Among other things, he refused to install a bathroom or a kitchen sink in their house, to put in a furnace, or to replace their outboded wood-burning stove. He bought his wife no clothing or household goods, would not give her money to visit her grown daughters, and insisted on paying for the groceries himself, refusing to allow her to use either his money or his credit. Far from being a poor man struggling to survive, Mr. McGuire had property worth approximately $200,000. Now, what happened when Mrs. McGuire went to court? While noting that Mr. McGuire had a reputation for more than ordinary frugality, the Nebraska court decided that Lydia McGuire had no case and dismissed her petition for additional support. The court held that although Mrs. McGuire had a legal obligation, well, he had a legal obligation to support his wife, the court would not tell him how to do so. It said, and this is a quote from the decision, "The living standards of a family are a matter of concern to the household and not for the courts to determine. Even though the husband's attitude toward his wife, according to his wealth and circumstance, leaves little to be said on his behalf. As long as the home is maintained and the parties are living and husband and wife, it may be said that the husband is legally supporting his wife and the purpose of the marriage contract is being carried out." Okay. So this is in 1953, example of how the law sees that contract. In its eyes, Mr. McGuire was fulfilling his part of the contract. Okay. Now, another interesting case was the Hardy case, and this is 1970. Here we are right in the middle of the women's liberation movement. And it's also often referred to as the case of Mrs. Hardy's allowance. Mr. Hardy was a fairly well-to-do executive who gave his wife a rather small but adequate allowance to provide for luxuries and household maintenance. Mrs. Hardy had this kind of latent dimension of being a good businesswoman, and she began early in their marriage to save parts of this allowance, some of which she invested quite wisely, and this little nest egg grew in size considerably up into the hundreds of thousands. The Hardys were divorced at a later time, and Mr. Hardy sued her for the property she had acquired with this allowance, stating that it's as it was based on the money he had given her in his supportive role, it legally belonged to him. And he won his case. Okay. So this is another example of who has the authority, who has the power, and why. Finally, there's my favorite, the case of Mrs. Glover's misbehavior. Mrs. Glover was the wife of a businessman who apparently did not live up to her half of the contract of keeping the house and maintaining the children. Instead, she entered into several small business concerns and this kind of thing. And Mr. Glover decided to sue when they were divorced. He sued for divorce on the basis that she had engaged in grievous conduct. And I'd like you to hear, he also denied her support on the basis of this bad conduct, of the fact that she had never done her part of the marriage contract. Now, in the testimony, we hear the following. On several occasions, Mr. Glover was compelled to entertain clients alone at his house and to cook dinner for them, since petitioner, who was aware of the social engagements, came home several hours late, and on two occasions came home at about 12 midnight. You're all in for it. Okay. One of the respondent's witnesses testified that the petitioner's home was a mess. In sum, the court felt that Mrs. Glover was a most attractive, articulate, and youthful-looking woman, apparently in her 40s, but fiery, volatile, ruthless, self-centered, cunning, and uncompromising. These are the words of the court, and completely undeserving of a support order. Okay. So that there's how we find the legal definition of the wife's part of the contract. That not only are you supposed to do these things like keep the house, raise the children, and perform sexually, but that you're really supposed to do a super job of it, or you're liable to this definition that you haven't performed it adequately, and therefore you're not entitled to anything when the marriage falls apart. Okay. Now, some of the challenges to this kind of legal situation that have come about in the past few years are the following. First, some people have decided when they get married to make up their own contract, that one way of overcoming assumptions the law makes is to write down something that says you're aware of those assumptions but that you're contradicting them from the beginning, that that's not your understanding about what this marriage is supposed to be. It is at this point, one thing to watch in the newspapers will be what happens when people in these situations seek divorce. Will the court treat them in terms of the contract they wrote, or will it continue to treat them in the traditional way according to legal assumptions about what the marital contract involves? This is something that's very much up for grabs now. Some decisions have gone one way, some decisions have gone another. Another trend is for states to start adopting community property acts. Okay, these are much more beneficial to women, obviously, because what they say is that any property or wealth acquired during the time of a marriage by either spouse is the joint property of those two people and shall be divided up if they choose to separate. Okay. So that's a new challenge to this idea that the breadwinner is the only person who has contributed. Another major contribution is the ideological contribution of the women's movement, which has insisted that maintaining a house, raising children, are economic services, and that one can at least hypothetically attach financial worth to the performance of those roles. So that this has resulted in some cases of bringing in economists who estimate what the worth of a wife's services have been over the 10 years that the marriage existed, and insisted that the settlement reflect the wife's economic as well as emotional contribution to the marriage. And this is a step forward. Another proposition which has been adapted by several of the Western states is something called the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. And it is a good compensation in states that don't have community property, because it basically says the same thing, that all the property that a family has acquired is joint property and should be divided up at the time of divorce. Now, it doesn't say it should be divided up equally. And at first, to women, that doesn't sound too good. Like, uh-oh, what does that mean? You know, I'm going to get 1/10 and he's going to get 9/10. The reason they don't is because of the act also asks that the court divide according to need rather than to contribution, okay? So that the court should take into account the needs and the financial abilities of each spouse in a divorce situation. And this has led to some fairly just settlements, such as those which provide women with support either for an indefinite time or with funding for education and job training to allow them to become financially independent, okay? Also, again, the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act states that alimony, where it is awarded, should, again, be awarded for need, not blame. Now, many of us, if you've never been in a divorce court, okay, we don't realize that another assumption the law makes is that alimony is some kind of a prize or a recompense for having been treated badly. That's the way it is seen under the law, okay? That, boy, that dirty rat is going to have to pay through the nose kind of mentality, okay? These people are saying, no, alimony is a support system. It has to do with what the other person needs, not whose fault the divorce is, okay? That's irrelevant to the distribution of property. Now, another factor which is making inroads into male authority within the family has been the increasing employment of women, which is a 100-year-old historical trend, okay? I always say that because there's a tendency now to see the increased labor force participation of women as a response to the women's liberation movement. I mean, you get this picture of Gloria Steinem getting up on a pedestal and saying something, and then everyone runs out and gets a job. And in fact, since 1862, women have been entering the labor force in increasing numbers, okay? There are a number of reasons for this, which I mentioned the last time I spoke to this group, that have to do with the opening up of legitimate middle-class roles in the 19th century. For instance, the roles of school teacher, social worker, nurse, and secretary were all created during the latter half of the 19th century, so that these provided good jobs, respectable jobs, that women could go to. These also were the areas of the labor force that were increasing the most rapidly. And at this point, there's an added impetus, okay? First, in the recession and the inflation, okay? Many people have simply returned to work because their families could not maintain a standard of living on the husband's salary alone, okay? And this has been true across the lines of social class. And it's not just middle-class women influenced by the movement who have run into the labor force. In fact, during the early 60s, the return was much more characteristic of blue-collar women whose husbands had done very well. I mean, if they were looking at their lives and they would think, especially with unionization, the acceptance of unions, their husband was doing so much better than their grandfather, their father could ever have hoped to do. But those gains started to be eroded by inflation and recession quite early. And it became apparent that if the family was going to maintain this good standard of living, it would require a second paycheck. Okay. So you have more and more women entering the labor force. Now, what does that have to do with power in the family? A couple of things. One is that when women are contributing to the joint income of the family, they will not stand by, we find, and let other people make the decisions about how that money will be spent. Okay? Having brought it into the household, they want a say in its distribution. Okay? So that in terms of adhering to traditional norms, putting aside the legal questions entirely, women just weren't going to sit there, turn over their paychecks, and say, okay, now what do you want us to do with it, dear? You know, they had their own ideas. Okay. So this has made women take a more active decision-making role in the family, bringing the American family a little bit away from patriarchy toward the democratic process of family interaction. At the same time, it also has provided women with more options. Okay. If we go back to the abuse situation, okay, people who stay in abuse situations are very frequently women who married very young, did not complete their education, did not get any employment experience between high school and marriage or between college and marriage, had their children young, and do not have a way out. At least they do not perceive it as a way out. If you talk to them, they say, but he supports us. I can't leave. And even upper middle class women will say, yes, but I've got my children in private schools and they're taking dancing lessons and they'd have to give all that up if I left. Okay. But a woman who can be independent financially has other options in a stressful marriage. She can leave. She knows in her own head that she's capable of making a living for herself if she has to, okay? So that this has also made an inroad into the patriarchal structure of the American family. Another factor that contributes to this is the lowering of the birth rate in the United States. Again, another long-term demographic characteristic that was interrupted by the post-World War II baby boom. The way we're presented with this in the press often is that there's been this dramatic decline in the birth rate since 1948 or something. And that's true. But if you back out to 1865, you see that the general line, if you could make one on the board, would be of a decline from 1865 to World War II, and then this big increase, and then an immediate drop. Okay, so that it's the baby boom that's the exception, not the lowering of the birth rate. Now, how does this give women more power? Okay. First of all, it is very hard for women to demand power, to wage a battle for power in a situation where they have a lot of small dependent children. They often feel they have much too much to lose. They feel that it might be damaging to the child's emotional and intellectual growth. They feel that that they have children clinging to them, so how could they go off and get a job if there's a baby in the house and this kind of thing. And women previous to the 20th century were very dependent on their own bodies and what their bodies had to say about their destinies. Okay, most women started bearing children quite young, and they kept right on bearing children until they either hit menopause or died. Right? And there were a number of reasons for this. One was the big value on children. One was the lack of birth control. One was the incredible infant mortality rate, so that women often had a lot of children in the hopes that a few of them would survive. Now, modern medical technology has removed a lot of these problems for us. We have birth control. We're pretty sure that the children that we bear will live. And we are having them young. and we're completing our family, Xiong, so that many women are through with the major part of their child rearing by the time they're 30 or 35. The youngest child is likely to be in the school system by the time a woman is in her early 30s. Okay. So this makes it easier for her to enter the labor force, and it gives her more mobility. She can leave again if she wants to. It's a lot easier to leave with two children than it is with 8 or 10. Okay. Now, another trend that has made an inroad in the assumptions about patriarchy have been changed notions about female sexuality. Okay, and this is more of an ideological than a behavioral change, but some of it is behavioral. What do I mean by changes in the image of female sexuality? Well, let's again flip back to the Victorian period for a minute and think about the assumptions that a middle-class man or a working-class man could make when he entered a marital situation. One was that he didn't have to fill anybody's sexual needs, okay? You remember when I described the contract to you that women have an obligation to fulfill men's sexual needs, not the other way around. Now, how did we inherit this legal thing? We inherited it from a general ideological notion that women were asexual beings. They did not have sexual drives or needs that had to be satisfied. It was generally acknowledged that the one drive in women was the drive to reproduce. Okay? Women wanted children. So that the notion was that women engaged, good women, of course, we're talking about, and we have to remember they made quite a distinction between good women and bad women. Good women engaged in sex, one, to please the man, two, to have children. So that men did not have to worry about whether they were satisfying a person's emotional or sexual needs at all. They could essentially use women, really objectify women, not treat women as other human beings in this regard at all. Second, since they are marrying these good women, they can assume that the woman has had no previous sexual partners with whom to compare them. Therefore, that they can get away with a lot. Because she's not going to know. I mean, you know, chances are she doesn't even know about the act until her wedding night, okay? And certainly that she hadn't had no sexual experience, whatever. Now, Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, the Height Report, have totally changed the American image of what a woman's sexuality is, okay? It is now, if anything, over-amplified, okay? I mean, Masters and Johnson tell us about 80-year-old women who had 40 orgasms in a night, and that can be very scary to a man, you know? Like, how is he going to meet these demands, all right? So you make this incredible flip, you know, from thinking of women as having no needs to a generally accepted notion that they have compelling needs, that they have voracious needs that have to be satisfied, and that part of your role is to do that. Which is very intimidating and therefore undermines some of the power assumptions of the marital relationship. You also cannot assume that this woman with these voracious sexual needs hasn't met somebody before who knew how to take care of them, okay? So that the young groom now has to worry about how his performance will compare to those of past lovers. Whether he's measuring up to these performances, and so on. And this introduces, again, the element of doubt. It also, in a very cruel way, arms women with something they didn't have before. Okay, that is that women just don't accept everything that a man does or says as the absolute truth and the best thing in the world. If they've lived with somebody else, they know more than that. Okay. Now, these are some of the factors which are undermining patriarchy from its gender dimension. And I'd briefly like to talk a little bit about the undermining of the age dimension of patriarchy. It used to be children were supposed to do what their parents, especially their father, said, because he was their father. And maybe some of you even remember conversations like that with your mother. But why do I have to do that? That makes no sense. And your mother says, because he's your father. Okay. And that was supposed to be enough. Okay? I mean, you're supposed to accept that. He's your father. Oh, okay. You know. And you have to remember, again, that this is a hierarchy where father tells mother what to do, mother tells children what to do. Now, mother is always kind of a lieutenant. Okay, not the biggie, okay? It's just like, wait till your father comes home, okay? I saw what you did, wait till your father comes home. And it's kind of like being sent to the principal's office, okay? I mean, like, the teacher's not gonna deal with it, you're gonna go to the principal. That's the heavy stuff, okay? Male discipline is the real discipline, okay? And there are several bases for where this is being challenged as well. One is in the knowledge explosion. We can no longer assume that people who are older than we are know more than we do. And conversely, as adults, we cannot always assume that we know more than our children do. Anyone who has tried to work with fifth grade math would be able to tell you that this is quite true. Okay. And we're constantly presented with notions. People are giving you statistics like in Red Book or the Reader's Digest. Do you realize that more scientific discoveries have been made in the past 10 years than ever before in human history? Okay, that's very powerful stuff. And it means that by the time a child is in 11th grade, he probably knows more in a lot of ways than his parents do. Second, the tendency for this to be a nation of immigrants contributes to the undermining of adult authority through the easier adaptation of children to new environments. And this is a very interesting thing that we find, and I had not found this through sociological investigation, but through literature. At one point, I got very interested in autobiographical novels about the immigrant experience, okay? Mario Puzo's Fortunate Pilgrim, some of the work on the Jewish immigration to New York, and Claude Brown's book, Man, Child, and the Promised Land. And what we find in all of these immigrant situations, where the parents come from a relatively simple village or rural society to a complicated industrial urban setting, is that the child learns the system first. The child learns English first, for instance. The child learns how the subway system works. The child learns how the welfare system works. And the child then teaches the parent how the system works. So that the situation of immigration seems to force people almost into this role reversal thing, where in fact the child is teaching the parent. And it's much harder once that has occurred to revert back to traditional definitions of fatherly authority, no matter what. Now, the other factor is a little more complicated. I'm going to take a little bit of time on that. And that is that through psychology and developmental theory, and then passing into the hands of the state, we've witnessed a redefinition of the parental role in the past 70 years, I would say. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, again, let's go back. To be a mother has always involved a good deal of emotionality relating to the child care, patience. Victorian father, on the other hand, was a good father if he provided well for his children economically, if he protected them physically from dangers, be they wild animals, Indians, or what have you, and if he disciplined them so that they turned out to be good, God-fearing, obedient citizens. Okay. Then along come a few people like Sigmund Freud, Cooley, George Herbert Mead, Erik Erikson, and they say the father role is this really important, nurturant, emotional role. and people who play it badly ruin the lives of their children. And you begin seeing set forth very specific notions about what the good parent is. And the ultimate effect of this is that it makes people terribly uncertain about themselves as parents. And again, I'm arguing that this has had more of an impact on men than on women. First of all, because these new models insist on male participation in childbearing. And secondly, because to some extent women already knew that you had to be emotionally involved with a child. By definition, it kind of went with the job. Okay. Although women, too, are given some problems by this. Now, one way we could simplify this discussion would be to say that being a parent 70 years ago was pretty much what sociologists would call an ascribed role, which is something that's there and you don't change it. You didn't work too hard to get it. It's just part of you, okay, like race or age. Being mother or father was this kind of biological ascribed thing. And what we're seeing is a shift to what we would call achieved characteristics that are supposed to be part of this role. There are certain functions that you are supposed to perform to be doing a good job at this role. And this has then made people distrustful of advice from their elders, thereby, you know, reinforcing some of the other problems I talked about. It makes them very uncertain about themselves as parents. People think about things that happened to them as children and they say, boy, I'm never going to be like that. Or they read, take a psychology course in college, and then when it comes time to have children, they get very fearful about, oh, am I going to be really capable of this? Am I going to be able to do it? Or am I going to be too authoritarian or too permissive or too something or the other? Okay, now again, the role of the law is very important here. And there are four areas where we see the state intervening in the family to define the parental role in a very kind of high-minded fashion, okay? And I want to briefly speak about each of these. The other part of this that's very important, if any of you are interested in children's liberation, is the greater likelihood of the state to intervene in these situations. A lot of the things I'm going to talk about now were just ruled out by 19th century courts as areas with which the court should not concern itself because they took place within the family domain and that was not the job of the state. Now we see increasingly invoked the notion of parens patriae, which is the notion of the state as the supreme parent. And it suggests that when the parental role is not being performed properly, the state has a right to intervene in the process. Okay, now, the first area where we see this performance standard being set is in some of the confusion around custody cases right now. Now, way back when, in Roman law and in British common law, fathers automatically were given custody of their children. In American society, from about the mid-19th century on, women were automatically given custody of their children. What we're seeing in the past 10 years is a movement on the part of the courts away from using gender as their basis for assignment of custody, and rather looking more and more at the best interest of the child, or which of these people will play the parent role better. As a result, we're seeing more fathers being awarded custody. Okay. Secondly, there's another set of custody cases which reveals this very clearly, and that is a situation in which a child and its biological parent have been separated for one reason or another, and other people have stepped into the life of the child and played the parent role. Now, according to Anna Freud and her colleagues, these people have become the child's psychological parents. They have filled its emotional needs and done all the real things that a parent does. They have performed the role. Often, when there's a conflict in the past, almost exclusively, the child would have been returned to its biological parent. The courts, time after time, refer to the importance of the bloodline in resolving these kind of cases. Again, in the past 10 years, much more reliance has been given to the performance of the psychological role of the parent. Okay. So here's another kind of handwriting on the wall that we expect a performance of some sort within the role of parent, especially the father role, I would argue. Third, in medical situations where people in authority feel that a parent's ideology or behavior might place the life of the child in jeopardy, the court intervenes. And it uses and invokes the principle of parens patriae to order that the proper medical procedures be carried out. Okay. In other words, what it is saying is these people are not being good parents. Therefore, the state will assume the parental role and see that good things are done for the child. Finally, in the area of abuse, we find the courts assuming a similar posture, but also even setting up agencies which are designed to assess the degree to which a person is properly playing the parent role. Okay. Now, there are all kinds of futuristics we could do with this. And I won't get into them now, but it's kind of tantalizing, for instance, given some of the more recent biological experiments, we have to face the fact that before the end of the next century, anyhow, reproduction outside of the human body is going to be a reality. So one can then pose the interesting question of what will be the roles of the biological contributors? Will they be parents? Or will the state, having assumed increasing power in these areas, define for itself who can and who cannot be the psychological parents of these children? Interesting thought. Okay, more back to reality is a case in Colorado in which a man is suing his parents for $1,500,000. Some of you may have heard of this case.
He has been in psychoanalysis
for a number of years, as you might suspect, and he declares that the psychological treatment was necessary because his parents gave him a bad personality that needed treatment. Now, heaven only knows whether this man will win his case or not, but it's kind of like the Marvin case in that it doesn't so much matter what the court decides. The legal importance is that they're hearing it. That the court will sit to hear this case is a very important fact, because in the past, a court would simply have said, that's something you're going to have to settle with your parents. This is not a legal question. But the fact that the state now is into deciding whether someone has done a good or bad job as parent is what opened the door for this case to be heard. So this is the basis on which, another basis on which patriarchy is being undermined in the age dimension. Okay. Now, let me just wind up by saying that it appears that traditional authority, which rested very much on the automatic notion that older males within the family automatically deserved and would receive the respect and obedience of other family members, is eroded, is in the process of erosion. It certainly has not totally eroded, or we wouldn't see the abuse cases. Okay. But it is changing. And in summary, there are a few basic things to say about what's doing this. One is the fact that women have been given a wider range of legal rights, which they can then use to gain more power or to gain freedom from the family. Okay. Second, economic participation on the part of women at an ever-increasing rate simply makes adherence to a contract that defines them as in the home doing, quote, nothing, is too outdated a system, and that there's just going to be incredible pressure for these assumptions about what a marriage is in the law, that it will have to change. That new ideology, which gives support to women as sexually active, as assertive, as full human beings, makes their treatment within family situations as some kind of second species much less tolerable to everyone concerned. And that ideological and technological changes have contributed to both the female push for power and the youth push for power. One effect of this is that we can see as sociologists and demographers is that people are choosing options of living other than the nuclear family. Now, the nuclear family, or the traditional American family, or the mythical American family, whatever you wish to choose it, I want to make clear what I'm talking about, consists of father who goes out to work, mother who stays home in a fluffy apron, Dick, Jane, Spot, and Fluff. Okay. It's estimated at this point that only 16% of real American families look like this. Okay? Either father isn't going out to work, or mother is, or they only had Dick and forgot about Jane, or they've got father's mother living with them, or they've got a cousin who moved up from the South and hasn't found a job left yet living with them, or they aren't married at all. Okay? So that just looking briefly at some of the changes from the 60 to the 70 census that we will probably see perpetuated in the 80 census, the decision to remain single was the largest change in family arrangements was in the number of people who are choosing not to marry. Okay. In addition, we're seeing increases in single-headed families, that is, a person and young children of one sort or another. Much of this is female-headed. It springs from widows who were created by the Vietnamese War. It springs from the fact that women tend to live longer than men. It springs from the decision of a growing number of teenagers to opt for single parenthood. Okay. And it also, of course, reflects the growing divorce rate, which is now over a third, heading for 50% by the year 2000. Okay. And in addition, the tendency of people to live together without getting married is another very fast-growing phenomenon. It is so fast-growing, again, the legal stuff is interesting, that the government has had to acknowledge it. So that on your census form, when you get it, along with married, single, widowed, separated, and divorced, you'll find a new category called mingled. Mingled is when you are living with a person but not married. And I think this is kind of a victory. I mean, we have to grasp at straws, but it indicates that when people insist on maintaining a behavior pattern that tradition has ignored, that sooner or later official sources are going to have to acknowledge that it exists. I mean, this is a statement the government finally has to say, yeah, well, they're out there, you know, and if we're going to count them and actually find out what people's lifestyles are, we're going to have to acknowledge the existence of this type of living arrangement. Now, what all of these things add up to in terms of youth culture, labor force participation on the part of women, control of reproduction, changing the laws, and so on, is that what women have been able to do for themselves in this century, if I could sum it up, is increase their options. Okay. Often we talk about power in the family. I was asked a couple of months ago to write an article called Confronting the Fearful Father, and what I was supposed to do was talk about how within the family this great drama is being played out where women wrest power from the hands of men. Okay. In my own experience, this has not been how women's power has manifested itself. Okay. Not by jumping up and down saying, you're not going to rule this family anymore, I'm going to, or we're going to share, or what have you. It's been more women exercising their choices, whether other people wanted them to or not. I mean, if the choices are now quite multitudinous, you don't have to stay in a situation that's uncomfortable. You don't have to stay in the home if you want to go out and work. You don't have to live in a house where you're the victim of psychological or physical abuse, because the society is flexible enough at this point to provide you with alternatives that didn't exist before. And that to the extent that women use those options and take advantage of them, they're demonstrating the shift in power that has taken place within the family. And finally, I wanted to say that another kind of public paranoia is that if this is happening, it means we're headed toward a matriarchal system, and we're going to see these kind of Amazonian figures ruling their families, making unhappy, nervous wrecks of their sons, and turning out more Amazonian daughters to rule the next generation. There is absolutely no indication of this whatsoever. If any progress is being made, it's being made in the direction of coming closer to the democratic model of family than to the matriarchal model of family. A woman approached me this morning after I had given a talk and said, "You're sure all this isn't just going to destroy the male ego?" And I was with a psychiatrist who patted me on the back and said to the woman, "You don't have to worry. The male ego is alive and well in the United States." So I will close on that note.